Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here, according to the Department of the Treasury, is the looming debt limit fight in a nutshell. What part of Armageddon do you people not understand? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 3rd of October. Great, as always, to have you with us. Day 3 of Government Interrupt Us is barely in the books, and yet it seems people have already moved on, gotten bored, perhaps, with a mere shutdown. Today, the Treasury Department went into full-blown the apocalypse is upon us mode, a 6-page report outlining the dire results should the debt limit be breached come October the 17th, give or take. We have, as you know, been close before, so there is some market track record we can look to see what happens. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports now on what we might expect this time around.
Last time the U.S. government squabbled its way towards even the possibility of defaulting, it stung the economy. The Treasury Department report today recapped what happened.
Stock market went down, got more volatile. There were effects on consumer confidence.
Alice Rivlin is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. The S&P 500 fell 17%, U.S. debt was downgraded, and job growth slowed. It took months to recover.
It was a serious situation, even though we didn't default. We just talked about it.
But it's hard to say that the same thing will happen again because other stuff was going on at that time. Bill Stone is chief investment strategist for PNC Wealth Management.
That's really kind of the time when the Eurozone started falling off the cliff.
That also may have hurt the stock market. Even after U.S. debt was downgraded, the U.S. looked bad, but Europe looked worse. So global investors flocked to U.S. Treasury bonds.
You know, one thing that's different, which is definitely a good thing, is you do have the U.S. in a quite a bit better position in terms of economic stability. And you really have to say the same thing about the Eurozone.
Steve Blitz is chief economist with ITG. He says when it comes down to it, markets just don't believe the Congress would do something so insane as to let the U.S. default.
Every financial institution in the world all have their capital in U.S. Treasuries. I mean, this thing runs through everything.
But he says there's still a threat.
The real issue is what does the deal look like that gets government back to work, that raises the debt ceiling?
Meaning, will there be some kind of brutal compromise that cuts government spending deeply or randomly like the last time around?
That's the critical thing. That's what we're going to live with. And if it is a deal that is a little bit too draconian, it's going to slow the economy down.
So not only would failing to raise the debt ceiling by October 17th hurt the economy, and not only might arguing over raising the debt ceiling hurt the economy, but resolving the debt ceiling problem might hurt the economy. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
There is a certain amount of trickle-down economics to the government shutdown story. The government is closed, so national parks are closed. National parks are closed, so vacations are ruined. Vacations are ruined, so vacationers are asking for refunds. And you know what? Sometimes they're actually getting them. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
If you were planning on flying to Arizona this weekend to take a donkey ride through the Grand Canyon or maybe jet off to Wyoming to watch Old Faithful do its predictable dance in Yellowstone, you might want to call the airline, some of which are offering refunds in the form of vouchers.
A voucher is no loss of revenue. It just allows the customer to take the trip later without getting gouged for a change fee. But the airline still keeps the money.
Michael Boyd is an airline consultant with the Boyd Group. He says it's unlikely that the airlines will see a substantial loss in revenue because there aren't a lot of tourists traveling this time of year. The exception, though, is Washington, D.C. airports.
That's the gateway to get inside the Beltway. Since the Beltway is now closed, you're going to have people canceling trips.
Boyd says a prolonged shutdown could cause a 20% drop in D.C. air traffic. On the other side of the country, just outside of Yosemite National Park, Peggy Mosley is the innkeeper at the Groveland Motel. She says business is slower than normal because of the shutdown.
Our employees don't get paid when we don't have guests.
I talked to Mosley a couple of months ago when her business had dropped dramatically after the August Rim fire. Many of her employees had to file for unemployment as a result. She was expecting a rebound as tourists came to see huge fields of wildflowers that typically bloom after a fire. Instead, with the park closed, she has fewer hours to offer her employees.
They are eating out of the local food bank. Their water and their propane is getting turned off. It is an incredibly difficult time for our employees right now.
The national parks themselves are offering refunds to park visitors. The U.S. Office of Travel and Tourism was unable to respond to my request for an interview. It's closed as a result of the shutdown. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
We told you yesterday about the possible perils of measuring the economic impact of a government shutdown when the government offices that do the measuring of the economy are shut down. Well, now it's official. The Labor Department said today there will be no joy in Mudville tomorrow. The September unemployment report will not come out. On Wall Street today, traders were spooked by the looming debt limit fight and by the shootings in Washington for a bit. Anyway, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Jim Yong Kim, a doctor by training, has been the president of the World Bank for about a year and a half now. Earlier this week, he gave a speech setting up his goals for the bank for the coming year, so we called him up to talk about it. Dr. Kim, it's good to have you here.
It's great to be with you, Kai.
I was reading your speech that you gave the other day about the goals you're setting forth for the World Bank this year with the meetings coming up, the first one of which is ending poverty in this world by 2030. And that's a great goal. It's lofty, it's admirable, but it's also kind of easy, right? Because who doesn't want to get rid of poverty?
Well, it's easy to say, and, you know, we've been talking about ending poverty for a long time, but this is the first time that we can actually see the end. This is the generation that can end poverty. So if the poor countries perform as they have over the last 20 years, they're going to get to about 6 or 7% poverty. We have a job to do. What we need to do is to figure out what they were doing when these economies were growing at their best, and then try to help each of the countries recreate some of that magic. So it's easy to say, it's morally extremely compelling, but it's going to be hard to do, and we've got a lot of work ahead of us.
The other thing that's going on in parts of the developing world, and you talk about this, you talked about this rather in your speech the other day, is conflict and refugees and displaced people and destruction of infrastructure. You talk specifically about the Middle East and Lebanon and Syria. How much is the World Bank? How much should the World Bank be paying attention to those places in the world where there is conflict and where economics, frankly, takes a second seat to survival?
Well, you know, the Secretary General, who I've been working very closely with, and
of the United Nations, yes,
of the United Nations, who I've been traveling with and working with, when he came to a meeting and he addressed the finance ministers of the world, he said it very clearly. He said, you know, every situation of conflict I've been in, underlying that is a lack of development, is poverty, is deprivation. And so I think we've always kind of known that that's the case. But the way that we've been working is that the peacemakers come in, the diplomats come in, try to organize some sort of peacemaking process. We sort of then wait until we see if the peacemaking process is going to stick, and then we go in to do our development work. We're not doing that anymore. We're going to go in simultaneously.
I want to ask you a question that's going to seem a little bit out of left field, but I just want you to go with me. And the question is, what is your appetite for risk? What is your appetite for failure? Because it seems to me that if you have these goals of ending poverty and raising women and controlling climate change, you have to be willing to fail, to try things that aren't going to work. How comfortable are you with that?
You know, Kai, not only am I comfortable with failure, I come from a profession where we have a very systematic way of dealing with failure, and this is the medical profession. Yeah. If somebody dies on your watch, then what happens is you get in front of all your colleagues and say, this is what I did, this is what I was thinking, and the patient died. What can we learn from this? We call it mortality and morbidity rounds. And so I actually had a mortality and morbidity round for development here at the World Bank. We took some of our most spectacular failures, put them in front of the whole team and said, look, this is a great lesson because these folks did great work. They conceived of the project well. They took on a really tough issue. we failed, but look at how much we can learn from it. So I'm really trying to shift the mentality from a risk-averse culture to one that says, let's take smart risks, and the only thing that can go wrong is if something fails and we don't learn from it. I hope that it'll work here. So far, I see some changes that are encouraging.
Jim Yong Kim is the president of the World Bank Group. World Bank annual meeting is coming up in about, what, a week and a half or so. Thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, Kai.
There's a case to be made that Target is the ultimate team player. It's paired up with big names in fashion like Philip Lim and Jason Wu, interior designers and celebrity chefs as well. But its latest partnership is more finance than fashion. The retailer said today it's getting into the prepaid phone card business. This weekend, it launches a new service called the Bright Spot with a new partner called T-Mobile. Sally Herships dials us into that one.
T-Mobile has been making a name for itself as a carrier that needs no commitment. Don't want to be tied down with a 2-year contract and last year's phone? No problem. T-Mobile feels your pain. Check out this ad for one of its prepaid plans. In it, a mugger rejects a phone he's about to steal.
This the phone you use?
Yeah, it's sweet. No, you want the charger?
I don't want this.
It's a good phone, man.
No, this is not a good phone.
Target hopes its new prepaid plan, Bright Spot, $35 a month to talk or text, or $50 if you want data, will let it cash in on the movement to cut the contract cord and bring in new users who'd rather pay as they go.
Customers can buy these prepaid phone cards in a variety of different locations.
Jeff Kagan is a technology analyst. He says prepaid phone cards are available at gas stations, grocery stores, not to mention Target competitor Walmart.
The question is, why hasn't Target gotten into this space?
The business is worth several billion a year in the U.S., says Bert Flickinger, managing director of Strategic Resource Group.
It's a way for Target, one, to keep its guests or shoppers away from competitors.
And two, Flickinger says Target gets most of its sales from apparel and accessories, and those consumers only shop so much.
It's a way for Target to get more and more consumers who are cash and credit constrained to come in their stores on a monthly basis instead of a quarterly basis.
Flickinger says the plus for consumers is obvious. It's flexible and easy on your cash flow. And Target is doing its best to target new customers. The retailer says consumers will receive a $25 gift card for every 6 months of consecutive usage. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I'm probably the only fashion business who has been through 3 private equity deals.
High-end fashion isn't always fun, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. I was kind of expecting the wah-wah trombones today, actually. The Dow Industrial's off 136 points, just shy of 1%, 14,996. The NASDAQ lost 40 points, about 1%, 3774. The S&P 500 down 15 points, almost 1%, 1678 at the bell there. The shutdown hit defense contractor United Technologies, which said it's going to furlough 2,000 workers on Monday, 1,000 more possibly if the mess drags on. The stock off 1.2%. The pain was the across-the-board kind of pain. Apple sliced off more than 1%, Boeing down 2%, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs both fell about 1%. Angie's List crossed off 17% today on investor worries about a shift in the online review services business model. The company has cut some subscriber fees. Eli Lilly took off 3.5%. The drug maker said it's not going to meet targets due to slowing business in emerging markets. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.60%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
on the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Friday. How did the employment situation in the U.S. shape up in September? Just take a guess, because it looks like the monthly jobs report isn't going to be released. So why not turn your focus to the red planet? World Space Week gets underway with the theme Exploring Mars, Discovering Earth. And she created the seductive vampire Lestat, among many other characters of the night. Author Anne Rice turned 72. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There were some lukewarm economic numbers out of China this week, their statisticians still being on the job and all. Chinese manufacturing didn't grow as quickly last month as everybody'd been expecting. Yet another sign of the slowdown over there. Our man in China, Rob Schmitz, is going to spend the next year or so on a series about that slowdown, China's hangover, he wants to call it. Stories of the aftermath of 3 decades of amazing economic growth. He gets us going with a story about the flow of capital in the world's biggest communist country. 97% of small businesses in China can't get a simple bank loan. So today, Rob takes us to the birthplace of Chinese shadow banking.
This is the sound of Wenzhou. Thousands of small factories like this one line the streets. For years, this neighborhood has made much of the world's metal cigarette lighters. A couple of miles away, a neighborhood specializing in shoe soles. And the district beyond that, felt-tip pens. Nearly all of them, small private businesses getting no help from the government. Wenzhou businessman Huang Fajing explains.
We're a coastal city near Taiwan. The government was always scared Taiwan would bomb or invade us, so the government never bothered to invest any money into our infrastructure. They left us alone.
Some say the government got out of the way, allowing the capitalist-minded people of Wenzhou to develop their own economy, complete with a lending system that predates banks, where a loan is simply a pile of money pulled together by friends and family.
I began making cigarette lighters 20 years ago. 4 of my family members each put in $1,500 and lent it to me without interest. That's what we call a Wenzhou loan.
Thanks to his Wenzhou loan, Huang Fajin made a fortune selling cigarette lighters. Chinese media now call him the Lighter King. On his road to cigarette lighter fame and fortune, the Lighter King watched on as more money flowed into Wenzhou. Loans were no longer limited to just family and friends. The Wenzhou loan became a lot less innocent.
Bigger groups of lenders began to form. They pooled money together and took turns taking out loans. Then they started lending money with very high interest rates to strangers.
This system of lending in all its variations is called shadow banking. It's now popular throughout China. In a report earlier this year, J.P. Morgan Chase estimated China's shadow banking industry could be worth up to 70% of the country's GDP. China's central bank has become so worried about this that in June it essentially froze lending between the country's banks, sending global markets into a free fall. The big concern here is that if China's economic growth continues to slow down, all these off-the-books loans won't be paid back. Along a busy thoroughfare in Wenzhou, simply called Shoe Street, shoe factories that export to Europe are now, like the EU, suffering. Shoe factory owner Gao Shenyi sits inside his storefront, sipping tea and smoking cigarettes with his friends. He wears a silver chain around his neck, bright red shoes, and a tight T-shirt filled with random English words. Staple text, free floral decorative pack, January, and so on. The shirt's tucked into bright white chinos, showing off a sparkly rhinestone belt buckle. His friends are dressed like Chinese gangsters, too. There's a reason for that.
My friend lent some money to a businessman who agreed to pay it back with interest in 60 days. But then the guy disappears. We've been looking for him, but he ran away.
This is becoming common in Wenzhou. Private loan defaults have soared over the past 2 years. Dozens of Wenzhou businessmen unable to pay back their loans have gone missing or been found dead. Yin Zhichao, deputy director of the China Household Finance Survey, has studied China's shadow banking sector for years. He fears these types of defaults could lead to social instability throughout China.
They have a sudden, far-reaching impact on everyone who's lent that money. From my point of view, China's biggest economic risk isn't from the existing banking system, but from this type of shadow banking.
And now China wants to bring this sector out of the shadows. A year ago, it chose Wenzhou to start a pilot program to legalize shadow lending networks, building a place where people can apply for these loans. But here at the Wenzhou Private Lending Registration Center on a recent weekday, there isn't one customer. Rows of chairs sit empty, and dozens of staff pretend to look busy surfing the internet. It's always this empty, says Zhou Xiang, a loan officer who works here. Zhou sits under a poster depicting a smiling elderly couple lying on their stomachs in a verdant meadow of wildflowers. The sky is blue, and in the background, skyscrapers rise from the pasture. It's a landscape that doesn't exist in China, promising loans nobody seems to want. I ask him why.
Most businesses that come here don't have a credit history. They just don't qualify for a loan.
Which is exactly how shadow banking started here in the first place. In Wenzhou, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
We're going to go to fashion now, about which two words, Jimmy Choo. High-end doesn't quite do that brand justice. You can spend $1,000 there for a pair of shoes, $2,000 for a purse. Steep, but entirely by design. Tamara Mellon co-founded Jimmy Choo with those kinds of prices firmly in mind almost 20 years ago. And her book about the experience is just out. It's called, wait for it, In My Shoes. Tamara, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I'll tell you what. It seems to me that shoes and fashion and all the stuff that's in this book ought to be a fun way to make a living, but it sounds really tough.
Well, I'm probably the only fashion business who's been through three private equity deals.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to the private equity part because clearly that was no fun. But it's you talk a lot about having to live the brand in this book, and Jimmy Choo is upscale and high fashion and glamorous, and that living that was draining for you.
You have to embody the brand, and journalists want to interview the person who's creating the product and operating the business. So you have to step forward and do that.
Let me back you up for a second and establish that there is actually a Jimmy Choo. He's a person.
He is a person. He was a cobbler in London who I went into business with in the mid-90s.
Why did you go into business with him?
It was interesting. There weren't a lot of great shoes around at that time. And as a lot of women will remember, there was Manolo Blahnik, and that was about it.
Even I remember that,
okay.
Not just the women.
So Jimmy was a cobbler. I was a fashion editor at Vogue magazine, and I would ask him to make things for shoots, photo shoots.
Right.
So I would go down to his studio, and I would tell him what to make. Okay, I'm doing a gladiator story and I want a strappy sandal and I want it in silver metallic. I'd photograph it and give him a credit in Vogue. So I thought, what a great platform to start a business.
When did you know that this was going to be a going concern, that it was a business that you were going to be able to live off of?
We got our first big order from Saks Fifth Avenue, 3,000 pairs. And when we saw the sell-throughs at Saks, we were having 95% sell-through.
That means of the 3,000 pair, 95% of them got
sold. Through, that means it sold through at full price, which is unusual. What you usually find is a 60% sell-through at full price. And then we had our big moment, which was really exciting, Sex in the City.
Sex in the City. So tell me the story.
Well, I didn't even know it was coming. And I got a call from a friend, said, hey, did you see Sex in the City? I was like, no. She goes, there was an amazing scene where Carrie Bradshaw's screaming, I lost my chew. I was like, really? And later when I spoke to Candice, she said...
Candice Bushnell, who wrote the story. Yeah.
She said she came to the store in London and she fell in love with the product.
Why, when you got into this, why did you put Jimmy Choo's name on this company instead of your own and run with it? Because you and Jimmy had a falling out. It was not an ideal partnership.
No, I put Jimmy's name because he was supposed to be designing the collection.
Yeah.
When I realized that Jimmy wasn't going to be designing the collection, that I was the one who's going to have to step up to the plate. You know, we'd open a store, his name was above the door, and I thought, you know what, let's just carry on with it.
Part of the reason that there's a tone of negativity in this book, right, about the business, because it was a slog, and I think you admit that pretty much up front in the book, is because of your dealings with private equity. Why did that go so bad? Because private equity is everywhere out there now. Why didn't it work for you?
for me, private equity today is just another word for a leverage buyout of the 80s. Mm. Initially, people would buy shares in a company. They were passionate about the company. They'd stay with it, help it grow. Today, you've got guys who want to come, they want to flip companies, fatten the pig for the slaughter, get their fees and move on to the next one with little care for the product or the people working in the business.
15 years after you start this company, you decide to get out. You decide to leave. Why? It was a raging success. Why didn't you want to do it anymore?
I'd been through 4 deals. You need history with the company. You need to understand the people, the DNA of it. And I felt that Jimmy Choo was losing the DNA. And I just thought I got to the time that if I don't take the risk now to leave and start my own business, I'll never do it.
Tamara Millen, her book is called In My Shoes. She is the co-founder of a company you might have heard of. It's called Jimmy Choo. Tamara, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, the Twitter IPO is upon us. The company filed what is known as an S-1 with the Securities and Exchange Commission late this afternoon. Basically, more details than we got a couple of weeks ago when they announced they were gonna go public. First things first, then the details. Twitter had $317 million in revenue last year, triple what it was a year earlier than that, though a net loss of $80 million is what that works out to. 215 million monthly active users, 100 million daily users. Plus, at least if you ask me, the real news out of this whole thing, the ticker symbol, TWTR, Twitter, which really is too easy. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. John Buckley, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for more tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.